I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in
the... Welcome to Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis. The April jobs data released by the Labor Department last week spurred an avalanche of hysteria and conservative hand-wringing about supposedly widespread labor shortages, with many on the right pointing to pandemic jobless benefits as the boogeyman. In a particularly troubling move on Wednesday of this week, 12 Republican governors announced that they would be ending access to pandemic unemployment benefits in their states, despite the American Rescue Plan Act's extension of expanded jobless benefits until September 2021. Analysis by the Century Foundation finds that some 895,000 workers in these 12 states will be cut off from pandemic benefits as soon as June 19th, with workers of color being hit the hardest, costing their state's economies nearly $5 billion. To help unpack the state of the labor market as the COVID-19 economic recovery continues, and to talk about the role of pandemic unemployment insurance in the recovery, I sat down with Heidi Shierholz, policy director at the Economic Policy Institute, former chief economist at the Department of Labor under President Obama, and a friend of the show, for a reality check on the jobs data and what they really tell us about the kinds of policies we need at this point in the ongoing recovery. Let's take a listen. Heidi, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Well, I always go to you as one of my favorite sources of sort of a reality check, as I put it up top, when there's a lot of noise out there around economic debates. We're kind of in one of those moments right now with, I described it as hysteria, and I think that probably is the right term, kind of going on right now about what's going on in the labor market and what the relationship between some of our federal policy choices when it comes to the recovery is to the labor market that we're seeing right now. I mentioned the April jobs data, and we'll get into that in depth in just a moment. But for starters, because we're seeing talk of so-called labor shortages seemingly everywhere, you're, as I mentioned, the former chief economist at the Department of Labor. So I can think of almost no one better to actually explain what the jobs data are than you. Talk a little bit about what these jobs data that come out of DOL are, and in particular, how we know a labor shortage when we see one in the jobs data. What do you as an economist look for in the kind of employment data that DOL, where you used to work, puts out month to month?
That's a really important question right now. So on the first Friday of every month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is part of the Department of Labor, puts out a big release, and that's where we get the overall number of jobs added in the month, the unemployment rate for the month, and other measures. And one of the things that's useful to note is there is no index of labor shortages. There is, like, BLS does not put something like that out. But it is important to note that we can look at those data and get a real sense of whether there's labor shortages or not. And that's because the way you identify a labor shortage is whether in a certain place or area or occupation or something, if there is in that place unusually very fast wage growth. And the idea of that is not that wage growth is a problem. We can talk about that. But the reason that just an unusually fast acceleration of wage growth is a sign of a labor shortage is because when an employer can't attract the workers they need, what they'll do is raise wages to poach workers from another employer, who will then in turn raise their wages to retain their workers, and on and on. So that's what you see. You get this acceleration of wage growth. And so that's a key thing to note, that in general, if you aren't seeing an acceleration of wage growth, there's very definitely no labor shortage. But if you are seeing it, then you have to dig in and think, okay, there could be something there.
So you as an economist, it's almost like you're looking for footprints in the data. I've heard you use that word. So wage growth functions, especially rapid wage growth, ends up functioning as sort of the footprints of labor shortages that we don't otherwise have an index for.
That's exactly right. That's precisely the thing that economists look for in the data to say, all right, our employers, in order to attract workers, having to accelerate wage growth to bring people on board.
So with that as a little kind of thumbnail sketch primer for the non-economists who are listening, and I know we have a lot of economists and wonks who listen, but there's a lot of us who are not economists as well. So I find that to be really, really helpful as sort of the shorthand to understand the rest of what we're going to get into. So with that as some of the backdrop, let's take a look at the most recent jobs data, which look at April and what they tell us. You actually recently wrote an analysis for the Economic Policy Institute with your colleague, Josh Bivens, who deserves a huge shout out here, looking at what's really going on in the data. What do the April jobs data tell you, kind of cutting through some of the hysteria?
So what the April jobs data show is that wages in leisure and hospitality, which is the sector that includes restaurants, they indeed have accelerated at a rate that would suggest that there is some real tightening in that sector. So we did see that in leisure and hospitality, but a really key thing is it was just in that sector. It is not a widespread issue. So that's key, this idea that employers in the entire economy can't find the workers they need. That is totally false. We are, however, seeing some signs of real tightening just in that isolated sector, leisure and hospitality.
So let's get into that a little bit, because you actually wrote in that piece that I noted, I'm going to quote you here, what we're seeing is actually a return to pre-COVID trends for leisure and hospitality workers, right? They're, as you put it, returning to wages that they had before the pandemic, but which are actually still far lower than prevailing wages in other sectors. You note that weekly pay for production and non-supervisory workers in, those are specific technical categories, in the leisure and hospitality sectors is now consistent with annual earnings of about $20,000 a year, hardly living high on the hog. But talk a little bit about what you infer from that wage growth within that sector. Is this something that we should expect to end up spilling over to other sectors and then becoming a widespread issue? I'm sensing from your comments already that the answer is no.
Right. No, there's a ton there in what you just said. And I want to back up a little and just emphasize one point you made that I think is so important, because I'm talking about wage acceleration and leisure and hospitality and how that points to a potential problem. And I don't want anyone to mistake those words for me suggesting that wages in leisure and hospitality are now in any way too high. They are not too high. And the key thing that you pointed out is these wages plummeted in the recession. They have accelerated in recent months, but they have just now regained their pre-COVID trend. Like, they are just now where they would be if COVID had never happened. So the idea that these wages are too high is really ludicrous. But we do want to, like, there's a difference between wage levels, which are remain much too low right now, and then what's the rate of change. And the levels and the rate of change tell us different things. And so I just want to be really clear about that. And so to get to the actual question that you asked is that, what do we have to worry about? Like, and one, if we are, you know, we are seeing this real tightening in leisure and hospitality, or we have seen it in the last couple of months. One thing you would want to look out for, now that we're seeing this kind of wage acceleration in leisure and hospitality, is whether that might spill over into other sectors and then drive some kind of economy-wide overheating. That could be a problem, but that is not something we have to worry about here. And there's a few reasons for that. One is that the leisure and hospitality labor market is very segmented off from other sectors. I mean, we've all talked about this throughout this entire crisis, a very striking feature of the COVID recession and the K recovery that has followed it is just how insulated other sectors in the economy have been from the extreme labor market distress in face-to-face services. And you mentioned this, Rebecca, but wages in leisure and hospitality, even with the recent acceleration, are still far, far lower than they are in other sectors. And that means those increases are just not going to create broad wage pressure. And I'll just say one other thing on this one. The total amount of wages in the leisure and hospitality sector account for just 4% of the total amount of wages in the U.S. economy. At that size, the wage trends in that sector are just not going to meaningfully affect the trajectory in other sectors.
And to cut through a little bit of the jargon there, right, because folks might be going, okay, well, you're saying that like certain sectors are insulated or that they're kind of segmented off. Like what that really means, I think what you're really saying is that if you think about this in human terms, that just because you've got restaurant workers, most of whom are actually still overwhelmingly part-time workers, seeing wage growth that is bringing them back up to what they had before the pandemic, that doesn't mean that we're going to see a whole bunch of, say, workers in manufacturing or even say white-collar workers in professional sectors all of a sudden be able to go to their employers and demand notably higher wages just because of restaurant workers seeing wage growth, right? It like doesn't even quite follow logically.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're just not going to see other workers being able to say, look, you better pay me more, or I can quit and take a better paying job in the restaurant industry, because that doesn't exist. Like even with the recent acceleration, restaurant wages are still way lower than what workers in other jobs typically get. So it's just not, we don't have to worry in a case like this that it's going to lead to widespread overheating. It's just a non-issue.
And I also want to underscore one other point that you made, and then we'll get into the subtext of why this matters so much. And of course, that's pandemic unemployment insurance and other policy choices. But you've made a couple of times the point, and I think it just really bears repeating, that wage growth is not a bad thing. And so we're not trying to say that wage growth, particularly among workers who already are not being paid enough, is itself a bad thing. And in fact, because we're in a period where we want to see recovery from a downturn will require a period of wage growth. And that's because we are trying to get back to what we saw before the pandemic. So this is actually, to some extent, a normal experience and something that we would expect, unless we're looking to have the recession create long-term scarring and pain for workers, even after we've, quote-unquote, recovered.
That is exactly right. We saw wages in leisure and hospitality plummet in the recession. That has to be made up at some point, or workers are going to be permanently worse off as a result of this, and that doesn't have to happen. So we need that acceleration to happen. The concern that people have now is, has it happened so fast? And in particular, not just getting to the point we are now, but if the wages do continue at their trajectory they've been going at, that could pose a bit of a problem because they've been rising so fast in recent months. But the idea that wages are somehow out of whack right now is utterly false. They are right where they would be if COVID had never happened. And, when we all know that even before COVID, wages in this sector were far too low. And I think a key thing there is, when you're talking about wage growth, wage growth isn't a problem. We know we have an economy that even before COVID had a lot of imbalances in it. Low and middle income workers have wages that have just not kept up with broader growth in the economy. The question is not whether that wage growth is a concern. We want wage growth. But we always want to dig into what's causing that wage growth, and is the cause of that wage growth sustainable? And if the cause of the wage growth is a labor shortage, that can cause some problems. But again, we're just now getting back to where we would be if COVID hadn't happened. The wages in this sector are just in no way too high.
So let's get into the why of why this matters and why we're talking about this, why there's been a lot of the hysteria around so-called labor shortages. The subtext for why this matters, of course, is our public policy choices. And the million-dollar question that's sort of at stake here is whether what we're seeing in the labor market and what you've been describing in unpacking those data tells us that we should continue or change or reverse course on our current economic recovery path, which has to date included significant macroeconomic stimulus and expanded jobless benefits, of course, to help keep workers afloat. I mentioned up top that earlier this week, 12 Republican governors took the extremely concerning step of announcing that their states would be cutting off access to pandemic jobless benefits. There's a range of different acronyms that implicates, but some of the key programs are pandemic unemployment assistance, pandemic emergency unemployment compensation, the extra $300 a week federal unemployment supplement that is in place until September, a few other elements of expanded unemployment benefits as well. And underpinning this decision by those 12 governors is the notion that pandemic UI, that pandemic jobless benefits are somehow keeping people from returning to work. That's always been kind of the boogeyman on the right when it comes to their stated concerns about why they don't want to see unemployment continue to be extended the way that it has been. Talk to me about this claim and whether it holds any water. You've been writing and talking lots on Twitter about how this is actually a myth and a dangerous one at that.
Yeah, we are seeing this everywhere. People are just, you know, seeing this isolated tightness in leisure and hospitality and concluding that pandemic unemployment insurance benefits writ large are damaging the labor market by keeping people out of work. And when you hear a claim like that, let's just go to the data. And if you look at what's happening, there is no compelling evidence that that is a driving factor here. And in fact, a lot of the stuff goes in a very different direction when you look at why we might be seeing labor shortages. So one thing is, I think this is really, really key. Workers in low-wage sectors receive a higher share of their income in unemployment insurance benefits than workers in high-wage sectors. But what we have seen is that these low-wage sectors saw much faster growth than higher wage sectors in the recent data, much faster job growth. That is exactly the opposite of what you'd expect to see if unemployment insurance were really keeping people from working. That points to it's something else. It's not UI, or we wouldn't have seen much stronger job growth in the sectors where people are getting the most UI. So that's key. And then I think there's a bunch of things, but another really important one to point at that whatever's going on, it's not caused by unemployment insurance. It's largely not caused by unemployment insurance. Labor force participation rose really rapidly in April, but the gains were entirely among men. Women actually lost ground. So what that means, given that we know women still shoulder the lion's share of caregiving responsibilities, that points to care needs as being the thing holding back labor supply, not unemployment insurance. And one point that has been really resonant for me in thinking this through is that in April, more than a quarter of schools were still closed to in-person learning. That means there's a lot of parents, and particularly moms, who can't work right now because of caregiving responsibilities related to COVID. That's cutting off UI is not going to solve that. It's not going to quickly open schools. It's not going to make sure we have the care infrastructure we need. It's only going to cause pain.
And you and some other economists as well have actually pointed out that we probably won't have a meaningful read on the underlying state of our labor supply in this country until September, which is when we expect a closer to universal reopening of schools. Obviously, a lot could change between now and then, but that's some of what some folks are expecting. So with one in four schools still closed while we're looking at these data, it's a different story entirely, I think, is what you're describing than a pandemic UI story. It's a story about lack of childcare, especially paired with the gender differences, as you were describing, between who's actually benefiting from those job gains and who's actually still losing ground. Women, still experiencing the she session that has been sort of the word of the day. You've also pointed out that another driver of reduced labor supply right now appears to be that millions of Americans are still concerned about health and safety on the job, which makes a lot of sense given that we're seeing vaccination rates increase, but not everyone is vaccinated yet by any stretch. And there's actually some evidence that you point to in that recent piece that you wrote with Josh, highlighting that vaccination rates are actually positively associated with increased employment state to state.
Yeah, that's really compelling work. We know millions of workers still have serious, legitimate health concerns about returning to work. And that data that you point to really underscore this, that as vaccinations go up, employment goes up. So that means health concerns are keeping people out of the labor market, but as those health concerns are alleviated, we see that dissipate. But it's still there, right? Like, we still have vaccinations are going up, but we still have high rates of COVID. We still have many people dying every day from this disease. It's still dangerous. And so cutting UI is not going to make that go away. It's just going to cause suffering for people who can't work right now because of health concerns.
So let's talk a little bit about the potential consequences of cutting pandemic UI. It's no longer a potential risk. It's something that we're actually seeing happen in those 12 states where Republican governors have said, that's it, we're pulling out. We don't want to let our folks access this special suite of pandemic jobless benefits anymore. What do you see as the likely effects of that decision by 12 governors to cut off access to those benefits? Obviously, we're anticipating great harm to workers, which I want to hear you talk about because I think that's really important to center. But there's broader economic risks as well, and that's a lot of what you've been really ringing the alarm bells about.
Yeah, the idea that a governor is going to cut off the federal unemployment insurance benefits while the economy is improving but still very weak is terrible economics. It's just the most nearsighted approach that I could sort of dream up if I were trying to. So it will absolutely hurt workers who either can't find a job right now or can't work right now. So it's going to cause an increase in, reduction in living standards amongst those workers, an increase in poverty. That will disproportionately hit Black and Latinx workers because we know that due to things like occupational segregation, discrimination, other labor market disparities related to structural racism, Black and brown workers have been hit harder in general by this recession. And so they're going to be the ones hit harder when you cut off benefits. So it will cause suffering. It will increase racial inequality. And then it will also drag on those states' broader economies. Because the thing is, those benefits that are coming from the federal government, it's the federal government and it giving an infusion of cash into those states. Those benefits are supporting spending. The idea that governors would look at that and say, nope, we don't want it, it's gonna actually harm their economies. So it's not only going to hurt the people who have their benefits cut off. It's going to hurt everyone in their state because it's going to drag on their economic growth. It's just like a lose proposition.
And I want to put some numbers to who the workers are who are going to be impacted here. These numbers come from a colleague at the Century Foundation, Andy Stettner, who is deep in the data on unemployment insurance and has been throughout the pandemic. He finds in his analysis that in these 12 states where Republican governors are taking this step or have announced that they're taking this step to cut off access to federal jobless aid, 895,000 workers will be cut off from pandemic benefits as soon as June 19th. He also finds, as you noted, Heidi, that workers of color are likely to be hit the hardest, that as a general matter, these workers are expected to lose 12 weeks of pandemic benefits, which, as I noted up top, is estimated to cost their state's economies nearly $5 billion. I'll come back to one other analytic in just a moment, and I want to come back to one of the threads you just mentioned, Heidi, which is sort of the impact that this is likely to have on those 12 states in particular. $5 billion in terms of lost federal aid might sound like, okay, well, you know, it's an arbitrary number. What does that mean in the context of recovery? But it doesn't actually take a hypothetical for someone like you to look in your crystal ball and say, what do we expect to happen in these states? Because you remember very well, actually, when you were at the Department of Labor, the Great Recession and the recovery, the very slow recovery following it, states that cut benefits, and in particular jobless benefits, after the Great Recession actually recovered more slowly than those who maintained stronger UI programs. So this is not a theoretical question. This is actually something we've seen happen before.
We sure have. One thing that we always know, like everyone knows, the recovery following the Great Recession was weak and slow, and that's true, but it's not a mystery. It's because we did things like this. We turned to austerity, to cutting spending, when the economy still needed the support. And it's not about unemployment insurance benefits, but I have another stat that really underscores this issue. One of the things that happened in the aftermath of Great Recession is the federal government did not provide enough aid to state and local governments to be able to maintain their spending. So they had to make enormous cuts. And just that impact delayed recovery from the Great Recession by more than 4 years. And that's just, I know it's a different issue, but it just underscores just how damaging these kinds of cuts could be. And so the idea that a state is going to voluntarily, in the aftermath of the Great Recession, right, it was the federal government was just saying, okay, states, we're not going to give you aid. That was out of state control. But what we're seeing now is that states voluntarily turning down that money, it's going to have a big drag on their economy. It makes absolutely no economic sense.
The other estimate that I want to throw in that also comes from Andy Stettner at the Century Foundation is he looked at the scary question, the even scarier question of, well, what happens if all Republican governors in the states pull out of this federal unemployment aid? What would happen? And the numbers then would grow to 4.8 million workers who would be at risk of losing pandemic benefits. And the lost funds to state economies would then balloon to $29 billion in lost federal aid. So huge, huge numbers that are potentially on the table. Are you concerned that we're going to see more Republican governors follow suit?
I think I can't imagine that we won't. There's been a real avalanche, and I haven't heard of specific states that are potentially going to go next, but I would be very surprised if we don't see more given what has happened so far and how quickly it has happened. So it's a huge concern right now.
And I want to kind of repeat something you said before, right, to anyone listening or anyone who influences policymakers in the states, right? Cutting back on pandemic UI provisions is not going to increase the labor supply of people who can't work and are not returning to work because of caregiving responsibilities, which are not yet fully addressed. So just want to underscore that point again as we think about, you know, what quote unquote solutions are actually what problems the solutions that folks are flocking to are actually seeking to solve. So as you and I have this conversation, we're in the middle, of course, of an ongoing national debate about the next round of economic relief. The American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan are kind of out there as the next tranche of policy measures under consideration on the Hill, and they would put major infrastructure and care and paid leave and other types of investments on the table for that next set of recovery measures. Given what we know from the data, what is your message to state and federal policymakers right now about the kinds of policymaking that we do need? If it's not cutting off access to unemployment insurance right now, which I've heard you loud and clear that is not the answer, are there other policy proposals that you think these data do tell us that folks should be doubling down on right now?
Yeah, the two big things that this really points to, if you really are concerned about, you know, labor supply and that you want to make sure that you do good, smart labor supply policies, the two biggest things are anything that we can do to help with vaccine distribution, but any policies around vaccine distribution efforts, getting the word out, getting vaccines to vaccine hesitant groups, all that is incredibly important to increasing, getting people back to work, making it safe enough for people to go back to work. So that's key. And then I would say as important or more important are investments in care work. There's been recent proposals, and the president has the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. Both of those proposals have large care investments in childcare, in elder care, in care for people with disabilities that make it possible. Those kinds of investments, having that care infrastructure in place, is the thing that makes it possible for people who have those care responsibilities to be able to work. It's absolutely fundamental to the good, to the effective functioning of our labor market. So real focus on that, really digging in and making sure that we have that stuff in place. And there's a lot of conversations going on, a lot of debate around this in Congress right now. I am optimistic that some key things are going to happen, but in my mind, that's just really priority number one.
And, you know, a set of policies that we actually spent a lot of April talking about on Off Kilter, because April is Second Chance Month, of course, is second chance policies, barriers to work that folks with criminal records face, and what are the options and strategies for removing those types of barriers to work so that people can reenter their communities following a period of incarceration, or even if they haven't done any time but have a criminal record that is standing in the way of finding a job. I want to bring that into this conversation as well and pose the question, do you see that as a set of policies? So record clearing or fair chance hiring or occupational licensing reform, all things that I'll refer our listeners to our full suite of April Second Chance Month episodes to hear lots and lots more about. Is that a set of policies that we also need to be centering right now if we're suddenly concerned about labor supply?
Absolutely. That's a really good point. I think what we want to do is look at what is narrowing opportunities, what's out there that are key barriers to work, and figure out what we can do to alleviate those. And so we know there are tons of barriers to work for people who have criminal records, have interactions with the criminal justice system. What we can do to get those out of the way, to make sure that people who want to work, are available to work, are able to get into the labor market, that's a really important
just sort of suite of things to really be focusing on as well.
So we're going to run out of time at some point sooner than I would like, given that there's a lot that we could be getting into in this conversation. But I'd like to zoom out just a little bit and translate some of the economic concepts that we've been talking about and ask you to do some of that translation because you're so good at it into human terms. So even those of us who aren't economists are familiar at some basic level or remember from school the concepts of supply and demand, but it can be easy to get lost in all of the economics jargon and to sometimes lose the forest for the trees with some of what we're talking about. You have noted in a lot of what you've been writing and tweeting about in the context of this kind of scare around a pandemic unemployment insurance and the myths about what it might be doing vis-a-vis labor supply, you've been doing a lot of kind of reminding all of us of the fact that really this kind of comes down to a threshold choice of what our priorities are in this recovery. And are they workers or are they something else? I'm going to quote you here and ask you to unpack what you mean in the following sentence and sort of what it says about what's at stake when it comes to the choices that policymakers are making right now. You write, a worker who is jobless because they have voluntarily decided that they would rather wait out the next month or two on enhanced UI benefits rather than throwing their caregiving responsibilities into disarray by taking on work in the face of continued school closures, or rather than braving a job that they feel might be unsafe for them right now, suffers far less than a worker who's desperate for work but can't find it because the economy is unnecessarily running at too cool a pace. Talk to me a little bit about what you mean by that and sort of what's at stake for workers right now as we start to see these kinds of critical policy decisions, many of which are the wrong policy decisions being made in this moment.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. One of the things that I think is that really resonates with me in all that discussion is one thing we know is that many jobs, particularly in face-to-face service jobs, leisure and hospitality jobs, restaurant jobs, they've become far harder and far riskier since COVID happened. And one thing we know is that a well-functioning labor market would account for that by offering higher wages. You should get higher wages if all of a sudden the job is harder, more stressful, riskier than it was before. So if the labor market were functioning well, that is what would happen. So one of the things that I think is going on is that pandemic unemployment insurance benefits are playing some role in actually allowing that to happen. It's what economists would call efficiency enhancing. It actually, those benefits, their existence is actually making the labor market function better by giving people a little bit of room to be able to not have to immediately take a job at very low wages that is much harder, much riskier than the job used to be. So in that sense, the economics of this, even if there is some labor supply effect of unemployment insurance, and again, all of the stuff we've talked about suggests that that effect is not large at all. But to the extent there is some effect, it's actually making the labor market function better. It's actually helping workers by giving them a choice to not have to be absolutely desperate to take a job no matter what, throw their care arrangements in disarray, all of the things that would come along with that, but gives them a little bit of space at a very difficult time to not have to absolutely take the first very, low quality job that comes along.
And you also write, and I feel like this just sums it up well and is probably the right note to end on, you write, the goal of economic policy should not be to chase as many adults into paid work as possible. It should be to provide good options and economic security for all. Is that part of what's going on here? Am I overly cynical to read some of this debate as not just hand-wringing around pandemic unemployment insurance, but rather actually concerned concerns by the proponents of our current kind of capitalistic system that has been failing many workers, particularly low wage workers. Are folks, particularly on the conservative side of the aisle, and those within the wealthy corporations who have been doing incredibly well, actually in many cases, billionaires as well during the pandemic, is there a concern that somehow what they're seeing is a shift in economic policy making away from a structure that produces a large and a constantly available source of cheap labor?
I think that's really key, that there is this idea that is on full display right now, that there is no job that's too bad, too low quality for people to who otherwise wouldn't be working to have to be forced into, that anything we do that gives workers some option is somehow damaging. And that's just false. It's that we know that things like giving workers unemployment insurance so they don't have to take a terrible job that throws their life into disarray actually can enhance labor market functioning, that we don't allow employers to have a set of workers that are so desperate that they can really suppress wages and job quality. That to like offer below market wages because workers are so desperate. If you give workers another option so that employers actually have to raise wages to a market wage in order to attract workers, it's actually a really good function of unemployment insurance. So the fact that we have unusually generous for the United States, and not for other countries, but for the United States, we have unusually generous benefits right now, has really highlighted just how aggressively many people in this country feel it, just how important they feel it is that we have to make so many people, that the most important thing is to make people so, so desperate that they have no choice but to take a very low quality job.
And in some ways, it has reset for a lot of folks the baseline of what one might be willing to accept by showing that it doesn't just need to be low-wage, crappy jobs that have no benefits and that you can't live on or nothing. Maybe actually we can make different choices. And of course, by pulling back the curtain, a lot of folks who are not a fan of that shift, right, are seeing the writing on the wall and trying to claw those steps forward back. So that we don't see long-term changes. So I think my cynical read, you seem to be validating. So I think that is some of what is going on here and sort of the specter. Heidi Shierholz is the policy director at the Economic Policy Institute and former chief economist at the Department of Labor under President Obama, a friend of the show, someone I always love going to for reality checks in moments like this where the myths are drowning out the facts. You can find lots more from Heidi and from her colleague Josh Bivens in show notes, including a recent blog post that they wrote that talks about a lot of what we've gotten into today and in greater depth, and a tweet thread that is definitely sort of the TLDR for folks looking for a little bit more of the data that Heidi's been sharing. Heidi, thank you so much for taking the time, and I always, always, always love talking with you.
It's been a pleasure. I always love talking with you too.
And that does it for this episode of Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart. Find us on the airwaves on the WEAC Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network, and say hi and send us your show pitches on Twitter at Off Kilter Show. And of course, find us anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
I want freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom.